To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. This is Aaron Carnes, the host of this podcast. After 4.5 years of weekly episodes, we are ready to stop creating In Defense of Ska. The podcast was meant to be a promotional push for my book In Defense of Ska, and it wound up taking on a life of its own. While Adam and I both love what we've accomplished with this podcast, we both feel compelled to focus our creative output elsewhere. The episodes we recorded remain evergreen, and we invite you to explore our back catalog, which will remain online thanks to the Consequence Podcast Network. I am working diligently on a new book, a novel called Little Black Book of Death. It's not ska-related, but it has a strong musical component. I also have a punk-themed script in the works. Adam is working on new music for Omnigon. We invite you to follow our respective projects and look forward to what the future holds. To keep in touch with my writing, follow me on Substack. That's aaroncarnes.substack.com. You can follow Omnigon on their social media accounts. Thank you.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
This week we talked to UK punk folk musician Frank Turner. He played in different bands throughout his life, but became best known as a solo artist. He released his first solo record, Sleep Is for the Weak, in 2007. His 2011 album, England Keeps My Bones, charted in the UK. He draws large crowds and works at a furious pace, releasing and recording a lot. It's been a while since we've had a non-ska guest on the show that we try to convince to record some ska songs, but that is on the agenda today. But there is some precedent with Frank Turner. Other people before us have tried to convince him to record a ska album. So far, he hasn't. We'll get into that with Frank today. And now, joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician, Adam Davis of the bands Link 80 and Omnigon.
So we've actually, one of the tropes of this show is for us to try to get non-ska musicians to make ska albums.
Yeah, so we have one, as far as I know, one success story.
What's that?
We had Brian Fallon on the show, Brian Fallon of Gaslight Anthem.
Yeah.
And you Adam Davis, pushed him pretty hard.
I did.
You were like, come on, Brian Fallon, do it. Record a ska album.
And what did we get out of him?
Well, what ended up happening was our good friends Cat Bite, who were listening to the episode, they hit him up. They said, hey, we listened to your episode of In Defense of Ska, and we think you should record a ska album, and you should do it with us. And so then about a year ago, I think they recorded together this Slackers cover called Yes, It's True, and they even roped in Chris Gethard, who's also been on the show, to perform in the video. So I take that as a huge win.
And can we also credit ourselves with the Laura Jane Grace Cat by Operation Ivy cover set?
Yes. I'm going to say that's because of us.
So Frank put out a new album called Undefeated on May 3rd, 2024, and it has a ska name drop in it.
It does have a ska name drop, so that is a start.
That's a start right there.
if the next, maybe the next one will have a ska section.
You know, some ska artists are scared to dip their toes into ska because they're not sure how it'll be received by the ska community. But in general, it's a welcoming scene. So we say, go ahead and do it.
I want to go back to what I believe was one of your first tours in the U.S. around the early 2000s, I believe. Is that when you first toured the U.S.?
I think 2007 actually was my first tour, I believe. But try me.
Okay, so around then, you Matt Flood booked a show for you.
Yes, he did.
Do you remember? So when was that then?
I believe that was in 2008. And I believe it was at the Space in Hamden, Connecticut. Is that right? Am I thinking the right one?
Yeah.
Sounds right to us.
Yeah. It was with Tim Barry and Chuck Reagan and Ben Nichols as part of the Revival tour.
Wow. Great lineup.
So that led to you doing, the single. It was a split with Franz Nicolay, right? The Sing Noel Coward.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was a great release. I love that. I mean, funnily enough, that Noel Coward cover is one that I very rarely sung live because it's got 10 million lyrics and I never fully learned all of them. So.
Learn it just enough to record it. And then,
well, you can have a lyric sheet in the studio. You know what I mean?
You
can read them while you do it.
Okay. So eventually, Matt, you know, you and Matt become friends and he kind of teases you about releasing a single off of a ska label, Asbestos Records.
Yes.
So then this leads to him making you sign one of his records that says the next album will be ska, I promise. This is how I understand the story. Is this how you remember the story?
Yeah, that tracks. Yeah, totally. I mean, Matt bothers me about ska pretty regularly.
Yeah. How often would you say you have been getting bothered by Matt about making a ska record?
I would say pretty much every time I see him, which isn't all that regularly because we live in different parts of the world and I'm a touring musician, but he's a persistent man and he's got a mountain he's going to die on.
Yeah. So on your the 50 shows in 50 states tour you did.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up, I think he was at your kickoff show, and he showed up with the shirt that said, Make Frank Turner Ska Again.
Yes, he did. Yep.
And so I feel like this is where it really kind of took off more, right? As an internet thing.
I mean, you tell me how much of an internet thing it is, but I know, I'm aware that quite often I'll see, I mean, I do my level best not to read comments on social media posts because I'm in my 40s. He will quite often, because we're like Facebook friends or whatever, it'll get highlighted for me. And it's like Matt Flood sort of banging on about ska again.
Again. Well, I mean, you know, of all the internet things to deal with, I think Make a Ska album is pretty light on the list.
I'll take it. You know, there are worse ones for sure.
Yep, definitely.
So, yeah, I'm curious about your relationship to ska beyond this sort of joke that is going on between you and Matt, or maybe from Matt directed at you might be a better way to put it.
Yeah, I think that probably is a better way of putting it. My relationship with ska, I mean, you know, I'm a 90s punk kid at heart. You know, I was like 14 when Dookie and Smash came out. So that was my formative kind of punk rock moment. I mean, I had actually just shortly prior to that got the first Clash album, the first Sex Pistols record, because Kurt Cobain talked about punk in interviews. And I knew precisely one person who knew anything about music, which was my friend's Uncle Simon. So I said, Uncle Simon, what's punk? And he said, oh, Jesus Christ, and told me to get into the Pistols and the Clash, which I did. And then Dookie and Smash arrived. And then, of course, you know, also on that pile, and one of my all-time favorite records was Out Come the Wolves. Mm-hmm. And that's a record that has some ska on it. And I think, like most people from that generation, because this is pre-internet, broadly speaking. So conversations between friends in smoking areas of schools and stuff, more so than message boards. But, you know, somebody would mention the Specials, so it's like, okay, I'll go and check out the Specials, and then this, you know, Selector and English Beat and Madness. I mean, Madness are a slightly different one simply because Madness is so huge in the UK that they're kind of culturally ubiquitous. Like, I knew who Madness were anyway.
Sure.
And I was almost slightly surprised to discover that they were sort of held in the same breath as, say, the Specials, because they went on to become more of a, I suppose, a pop band at a certain point in their career. I mean, and I should say, incidentally, that I adore Madness. I think they're one of the best bands ever. But yeah, so I kind of got into all that. And then, you know, and then there was the whole California 90s punk thing. So I had records by Goldfinger and I had Assorted Jelly Beans. So I love Assorted Jelly Beans. All Real Big Fish, all those kinds of bands, you know, I had a lot of those records. I mean, I feel duty bound to be honest with you good people and say that like the kind of the ska end of that scene wasn't necessarily my favorite bit of it. I will say that I also feel like, and you may know what I'm talking about here. I mean, you do a podcast about ska, so. I feel like there are kind of two types of ska punk. You know what I mean? There's the kind of more ragged kind of Operation Ivy, Rancid, and I guess the special stuff, which is kind of, it's kind of dirtier somehow. And I've got a lot of time for that. The more, the kind of cleaner, super fast ska thing. Do you know what I mean by that? Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, really sort of clean, super fast upstrokes. That stuff was less appealing to me as a kid, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah. So Frank, you're 42, right?
Yeah.
So you're right about the right age. Did you go see any of the UK ska punk bands back in the day?
So my experience of this was that there was the UK's version of this was that there was a kind of a little bit later, there was this thing that people at the time called Scarcore that was basically Capdown were kind of the kings of that. I'd like Jake from Capdown's a friend of mine and like they're a great band. But it was kind of harder edged in a way. Do you know what I mean? There was a bit more of a kind of hardcore punk attitude to it, which endeared it to me more because like as time went by, my pop punk phase shifted pretty heavily into a hardcore phase. But there was and Lightyear were great as well. They were really cool. So yeah, I mean I saw all of those bands a million times because Household Name Records, which was the UK punk label, which had initially been a hardcore label, sort of became a kind of ska core label at a certain point in time. And Lil, who runs Household Name, remains a very good friend of mine.
I just want to take one step back about the two-tone ska bands. So
sure.
you didn't really know, aside from Madness, you weren't really familiar with them until you started getting into punk? Because, I mean,
right.
I know you weren't a kid when two-tone came out, but that music was so big in the UK. I always wonder what like the next generation, like how it takes for them to discover it.
Yeah, it was big in the early 80s. I mean, it was a big kind of around the time I was born, to be blunt. You know, the two-tone was like 81, I want to say, which is when I was born. So, I mean, it was big in a way, but like by time you roll around to the mid 90s or the early 2000s or whatever, it's the kind of thing that you'd have to be reasonably nerdy to know about. I mean, to pick a comparative example, like Northern Soul, for example, Northern Soul was huge in its time. But by the time I was a teenager or in my early 20s, like you'd have to do some digging to find out what Northern Soul was, you know, and to get the records and all the rest. So I think the same would be true of Two Tone. So yeah, definitely once I figured out who the Specials were, kind of via Rancid, as it were, then yeah, I did the digging and I read books and, you know, watched videos and stuff. And I mean, you know, the whole legend of the two-tone tour is completely insane and in this beautiful way, and it's punk as fuck and all the rest of it. And, you know, you look at, I also think that, you know, the Specials are an interesting political moment as well. If you look at sort of when they were releasing records and the fact that they were a racially diverse band and at a point in time when punk rock had been very, very white up until then, and all that kind of thing. So, you know, there, I think I came to understand all of this, but it was a little bit later on.
Yeah, what's your understanding of, because a lot of the politics of the Specials coming out has to do with the National Front and Rock Against Racism and all this stuff. Is that something that you're like very familiar with as a person?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm a history nerd, first and foremost. I would say that, but one of the things that went interesting, a lot of people, and I say this with love and respect, a lot of Americans particularly, get a little confused about the timeline about punk rock and they kind of go, yeah, the Sex Pistols and Margaret Thatcher. And it's like, no, the Sex Pistols predate Margaret Thatcher by 4 years. Do you know what I mean? It's like the Sex Pistols were a reaction to the Callaghan government. That's a whole other thing. But the Specials definitely were a reaction to the Thatcher government. And, you know, Ghost Town was very much about the fact that Birmingham had been kind of decimated by the economic hardship of the early 1980s and the recession and unemployment and all that kind of thing. So it was quite, of course, there was a lot of stuff to do with the National Front, but in terms of your Ghost Town's quite specifically about Thatcherite economic policies.
So in recent years, I know you've toured with The Interrupters and Bedouin Soundclash, and you just put out a split with Bedouin Soundclash as well.
Yeah, I don't know when this podcast is going out, but we're announcing this tomorrow, so I think I can probably tell you. We're about to take them out on tour for a whole bunch of shows later this year as well. In the US and Canada.
I'm curious about your relationship with both those bands.
The Interrupters, we toured with the Interrupters. They're great. They're a really cool band. They have a wonderful fan base. I mean, honestly, we haven't really stayed in touch since the tour, to be blunt, but they were really cool people to tour with. We had a great time, and there was a really interestingly positive crossover of audiences, I think. You know, sometimes when you do a co-headline tour, you have the thing that whoever's playing first, like half the audience leaves when they finish, you know what I mean? And that didn't happen on our tour with them, which I think speaks well to both of our fan bases and indeed how we've interacted with them over the years. You know, like, it's just bad manners. You know, to leave after your band has played. And I think we both did well out of the tour, so that was good. Bedouin's a slightly different one for me, because Bedouin were enormously huge in the UK in the mid-2000s, and they were kind of on the edge of the kind of Strokes, Libertines, that kind of guitar scene, which I was also sort of on the edge of. But it's quite weird. So, like, my tour manager these days, Tree, used to run an indie nightclub in London, and she knows Jay and the Bedouin guys from back then. And I was friends with Tree back then, but I never met Bedouin for whatever reason. But you know, When the Night was just an enormous hit in the UK. When the night feels my soul. Getting to know Bedouin last year, as I did, was awesome. Like, Jay is one of my favorite people in the whole world now. Like, we're super good friends. But it should be noted that we both said kind of independently that we're quite glad we didn't meet each other back in like 2006-07, because we were both utter fucking nightmares as far as kind of like drugs basically went, and that we probably would have killed each other, you know what I mean? With big smiles on our faces, but we were both fucking nightmares basically, and if we'd been nightmares together, it might have been a perfect storm. So, and you know, we're both kind of cleaned up these days, we're both in better places, and that's lovely, and when we're good friends. But Christ, I can't even imagine the carnage that would have erupted if he and I had partied together in 2007. It would have been absolute fucking mayhem. But yeah, so I mean, it's interesting to me because, like, I guess instinctively I don't really think of Bedouin as a ska band, even though they are definitely a ska influenced band at the very least.
They kind of go in and out of being like leaning heavier into ska and then kind of like less ska. But their newest album is pretty heavy into ska. It's a really good album, by the way.
Yeah, it certainly is. I agree strongly. And they're a great band. I guess I'm going to try and phrase this carefully. To go back to what I was saying earlier about the kind of the clean upstroke ska, there's a certain type of ska which just feels very white to me. Do you know what I mean? It feels very kind of suburban Californian, you know what I mean? And like, and it's just kind of in my mental image is kind of like dudes with baggy shorts on and like maybe a polo shirt, you know what I mean? And it's kind of like, it doesn't, if you put that next to what everything we were just saying about the Specials and about urban decay and about sort of racial conflict and all that kind of thing, there's a chasm between the two. He said, trying to be diplomatic.
So with Bedouin, this is interesting. I want to just a little side tangent here. We've talked to Bedouin and we've talked about them a few times because When the Night was a huge, huge hit in Canada. It was not at all a hit here in the US, but it did become a big hit in the UK.
Yeah, it was enormous. It was inescapable in the UK. Also, I should just briefly say, I've just recently sung When the Night for a 20th anniversary duet split thing that I'm doing with them. So that's coming out soon.
Oh, cool.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So in Canada, we were just talking to Matt from Planet Smashers, and he was telling us that that song started to blow up in Canada because it was attached to an ad for like basically like a convenience store. And that got the ball rolling to make it a radio hit. But in the UK, I assume it was just a radio hit?
No, that song was on about 9 different adverts in the UK.
Really?
Oh, okay. So it also hit that as well in the UK.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you remember any of the advertisements?
I think one of them was a mobile phone, but I might be wrong about that. But it was, I mean, it was just one of those songs which was just inarguable. Do you know what I mean? And as much as I think at the time I was aware that it had been on an advert, I didn't really care. And it was in the clubs as well. So it was just like, you know, and it was a kind of end of the night song. Do you know what I mean? Like when you finish kind of dancing to Mr. Brightside and like Hot, Hot Heat and all that sort of shit. And it's like as they turn the lights on at 3 a.m., they put on When the Night. And it was like, yep, we can do this.
Mm.
So your new record, I want to isolate one little part of your new record. Your new record is called Undefeated. It just came out. You have a song on there called Never Mind the Back Problems.
I do. Yeah, well spotted. I think I know what you're driving at, and it's very well observed.
Give me hardcore, grind, and ska.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, this is the thing. Like, I don't want to come across as a curmudgeon on your podcast, you know. I mean, first of all, who fucking cares what I think about anything?
Oh, we care. We care.
Oh, well, you should. But more also, like, I mean, you know, ska punk and ska generally is, of course, broadly part of the kind of the underground counterculture, or however you want to describe it, that I consider myself to be a paid-up member of. You know, and therefore it's, you know, it's part of the furniture in a good way. It's great. I love it.
Yeah. So the theme and the kind of the what the new album is roughly about is sort of embracing aging and embracing aging as a person who's, you know, a punk and doesn't want to like conform necessarily to society's standards of what you're supposed to do as you age. Right.
Sure. Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's a lot of kind of like, nostalgia is not the right word. There's a lot of kind of like retrospect, should we say, and just sort of trying to sort of figure out how I measure up to what I thought I was going to be when I was this old, when I was a teenager. I mean, it's probably worth adding that, of course, when I was 16, I was like, I'm never going to make it to my 40s, man.
Yeah.
And now here we fucking are. But you know, I had very strong, clean cut, box fresh cellophane wrapped opinions when I was a teenager, and it's interesting to sort of measure up to that standard and see how you fare.
Can you give us a little taste of how you thought you were, you know, adults were, or what you wanted to be versus how you actually are?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a lot of different stuff. I mean, I don't know if you guys know what I mean by crime think. Do you remember crime think?
Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of anarchist sort of art collective thing. I was that hit me. I was the right age when crime things started. Like I was fucking obsessed with that and kind of situationism and the kind of early against me thing of sort of, you know, like DIY forever and blah, 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 blah. You know, and I was straight edge for a while when I was younger and, you know, no gods, no masters, all that kind of shit. And it's like, you know, and now I'm 42 and I've been to rehab and I've been on a major label in my life at certain times. And indeed, my older sister is a Green Party councillor in the UK, mainstream politics, blah, blah, blah. And indeed, I'm incredibly proud of her and salute her work. You know, I think this is a complete sidebar, but I think people who bother to go into local politics deserve a fucking medal because it's thankless but utterly necessary task. Anyway, but you know, so my view, I like to think that a lot of my priors remain the same, if you see what I mean, like in terms of kind of broad views of human nature and all that sort of highfalutin philosophical stuff. But it's just, I guess the thing is, you know, the world is more complicated than I thought it was when I was 15, because when I was 15, I didn't know shit. But of course, because I was 15, I thought I knew everything because I'd read half a book by Noam Chomsky. So you know, do you know what I mean? So like, it's interesting to kind of like measure those two things up to each other. And there's a song on the record called Ceasefire, which is probably my favorite song on the record. I'm not supposed to say that, but I just did. Which is sort of, it's about a sort of conversation between me then and me now. I'm just trying to explain that life is more complicated.
I mean, if you understand that life's more complicated as you get older, I think you have the tools to actually live a good life as an adult.
Yep.
Like you can get over like your old ideas as a child and sort of.
Yeah. For me, one of the most striking things about getting older for me is that with every passing year, I understand how little I know about the world. Like the vast expanse of my ignorance spreads out year on year, you know? And like every time I pick up a book to try and educate myself about something, it's like lifting up a fucking floorboard and just seeing like an abyss underneath it of things I don't
know. Sure.
It's just like Operation Ivy said.
Yeah.
All I know is that I don't know nothing.
Yeah, right. And hopefully I like to think there's some intellectual humility that comes with that. I mean, I'm sure I could tune it up a little harder than I do, but yeah, you know, just that general sense of like, I don't really fucking know what I'm doing.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
I want to talk, this is adjacent to ska, so this isn't ska, but I want to talk about Cuckoo Kangaroo.
Oh, yeah.
It's adjacent because they were on Asian Man Records in their early years.
Yes.
But they're a very interesting band. So you discovered them while you were touring in the Midwest. You played a festival with them, and they opened up, or they played right before you?
They did. It was called the Lower Town Music Festival. It was in St. Paul in 2010.
Okay, so you were watching them set up, and you were like, this band is going to suck.
Well, yeah, there's more context to this. Basically, so the day before, I had flown back to the UK for one day to go and get I got given a Kerrang Award, if you know what that is. Kerrang magazine is a big magazine in the UK. And they heartily encouraged me. And because, this was another period of my life when I was drowning in cash, nor am I now, I should add. But anyway, so I'd like taken a bunch of really fucking shitty kind of cheap flights to get home, been to this award ceremony, had a massive party afterwards, and then flown back to Minneapolis and was just like utterly fucked. And had like a night's sleep and was like hungover and tired and, you know, drained from the flights and everything. And I was on my own as well. And I wandered down to the festival site, and it was just kind of on a city block. There was just a stage. And these two guys in matching tracksuits started setting up with like an iPod and everything. And it just looked like it was going to be like a pitchfork band, you know what I mean, or a Vice band, and it was just like, fuck this hipster bullshit was my you know what I mean by that, right?
It exactly, like, yes,
probably going to be way too fucking cool and blah 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 blah. And they did a half hour show, and you know, they just chipped away at me basically. And I think the reason Cuckoo works is that there is not a drop of irony in what they do, and if there was even a drop, the entire thing would collapse in on itself. You know, they are exactly who they are, and there's no kind of like second layer to it. Do you know what I mean? They're just two dudes doing this completely insane thing, which is, you know, I guess you could say it's child oriented, but it's not just that, you know, it's just kind of joyous in this completely amazing way. By the end of their show, I was doing dinosaur dancing on my own, which I don't fucking do, in the middle of the street, you know, doing chomp, chomp, stomp, stomp, everything. I texted my booking agent and I said, I've just seen the best band in the whole fucking world and they've got to open for us. And he went and like Googled them and stuff and wrote back and he was like, I think you must have spelt the band name wrong or something, because this can't be who you're talking about. and I was like, no, that's them. And ultimately, you know, I choose who I go on tour with, but there is a collaborative element to it. There is a kind of discussion about aesthetics and ticket sales and all that sort of stuff. And it took me a few years to wear my agent down, basically, until eventually we had a tour that was just selling really well anyway. And he was like, fuck it, whatever, you know, put him on the bill. So we did, and that was like 2014, I guess, somewhere around there. And we played Terminal 5 in New York, and my agent, I made him. I was like, don't be a fucking booking agent. You're coming down, and you're going to catch the openers, and you're going to see Cuckoo Kangaroo, and you're going to see what I'm fucking talking about. Because on the tour up to then, we'd done a lot of touring. Sorry, I'm talking at length here, but anyway. We'd done a lot of touring with like Social D and bands like that, and I would watch them from the wings every day, and it was incredible because they'd come on and start, and it was like a game of guess who. Do you know what I mean? All of these fucking big punk dudes being like, nope, not going to have fun. And then one by one, they would go down and just kind of give in. Do you know what I mean? And like, and just go, oh, fuck it, stomp, you know? And it was just, and then, I mean, to be slightly kind of mechanistic about it, they were an incredible opener because they loosened the whole fucking crowd up. Everybody is ready to dance after a Cuckoo show. Do you know what I mean? And then we come on and just like hoover it up. But so Nick, my agent, he came down and he watched them play, and about four songs into the set, he just turned to me and was like, all right, fine, fuck it, I get it, you motherfucker. And we've done more with them since then, and they're now kind of the in-house compers for my last evening's festival, and they're two of my favorite people in the world. They're absolute sweethearts.
It is hard, and I think it's probably harder now with cell phones to get people to like 100% be in the moment in the show.
Really? Yeah.
And so like when you're a band, if you can do that, that's I think is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah. They're just so bizarre. That they kind of short circuit everybody's defense systems, like kind of, you know what I mean? Everybody's cynicism defense systems just kind of go into meltdown the minute they start, mine included. And, you know, and every year, like at Lost Evenings or whatever, there's always a moment when people are just like, who the, because they compare it, they MC at Lost Evenings, and people are just like, who the fuck are these guys? I mean, obviously, over the years, quite a lot of my kind of core fan base kind of know who they are now, but you can see people just kind of, like what is going on right now? And then by the end of the weekend, they're just like, yay, it's Cuckoo Kangaroo, or Cuckoo as they're now called. Yes. So yeah, awesome band.
There was an article, so Vice did an article, Dan Ozzie, who's been on the show, said that you dragged him to this like basement show in Brooklyn to see them, and it was the weirdest show he'd ever experienced. Do you remember this whole experience?
I remember it very well. That was an extremely fucking weird evening on a lot of different levels, because Cuckoo was sort of not quite in their usual context, should we say, because it was kind of like a extremely drug heavy kind of Brooklyn hipster house show, basement show, whatever. So like we went in and there was a lot of kind of very sort of flamboyant kind of, you know, sort of queer culture kind of people sort of running around and just handing out ecstasy and all the rest of it. You know, and like Dan doesn't drink and or anything. So he was just like, no, thank you, ma'am, kind of thing. And like, and then Cuckoo did their thing and it actually worked perfectly. Everybody was into it or whatever, but he was just stood next to me like, why? Because like I had a day off from tour and I found out they were playing the show, and I called Dan and I was like, motherfucker, you are coming to this show with me. And he was game, and he did it. He wrote a great piece. I remember it very fondly.
Did Cuckoo play their set in the same way they would normally play a set?
Oh yeah, totally. Like they, I mean, both of them, but particularly Brian, are just kind of like bulletproof. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, I was going to say there's no shame, but I mean, it's shame doesn't even enter the equation. There's nothing to be ashamed about. They just come on and he's like, all right, everybody, let's fucking go. And it was just instantaneously hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you did a split single with NOFX.
Yes.
And NOFX covered your song Thatcher Fuck the Kids.
Yes.
And it was ska. But you just closed your eyes to the other side of all the things that she
did. Thatcher Fuck the Kids. It was, yeah. Well, actually, you know, funnily enough, when we were doing my kind of ska life story earlier, I should have mentioned NOFX, because obviously, you know, 180 Degrees or whatever, there's a lot of songs in their catalog which have kind of ska elements to them. We did a split record. They did five songs, I did five songs, which is cool, and they did their thing, and it was fucking awesome. I mean, like, I regard that split as being my kind of punk rock blue tick, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
People can come at me as much as they fucking want, but I did a split with NOFX, so fucking eat my balls. You know, the only other band who ever did a split with NOFX was Rancid, so, you know, I can flex on that one. And like, they're good friends of mine. Like, Mike is a dear friend of mine. I'm aware that he's a kind of crazy person, but, like, he's a good, good human. He's an eccentric man, but he's a good guy. And it was, I mean, you know, I think that we're all roughly of an age where you will know what I mean. Like, to hear five of my songs with that fucking band, and they've got a distinctive everything, drum tone, guitar tone, vocal tone, whatever. And to hear lyrics that I wrote with some alterations, I might add, you know, being sung by NOFX was, I mean, I can't really overstate it. It was the honor of my life. You know, it's one of my favorite things I ever did. But also, I should say, by the way, one of my very favorite things about that split is how much a certain type of NoFX fan hates my side of it. You know what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And like, you know, if I'm ever kind of down and fancy a laugh, you can just go and read the YouTube comments underneath the kind of, particularly the more, like, we did kind of a country version of Bob. And like, oh man, there are some people in Brazil who fucking hate me for that. And it fills my heart with joy.
I love the video for Bob is hilarious too, because NoFX is lip syncing you,
yeah,
playing their song.
Yeah. Dressed as a fucking boy band.
Yes. And like you take stuff like you do a harmonica solo, but they still have the sax doing the, you know, pretending the harmonica and stuff like that. So it's pretty hilarious.
That was what was that split was so much fun, because right from the word go, the rule was that there was no conferring. Do you know what I mean? It's like I had no idea what songs they were doing or how they were doing them or what video they were going to make. It was completely, totally like unknown. And then, we agreed to do it in 2019, but we kind of finished it all off kind of during the pandemic. So it was like lockdown times in the UK, and I'm just sitting at home, and then there's this like link arrives and it's got that fucking video on it. And I'm just like, Jesus fucking Christ, man. but yeah, they did a good job.
So early at the beginning of the episode, we were talking about your 50 states and 50 dates tour.
Yeah.
Looking back, like how did that feel for you? Was that challenging to do that, or was that?
Oh, it was a fucking nightmare.
Was it?
I'm the third person to ever do it and the first non-American to do it. And I know why now, which is that it's fucking hard and awful. it's one of those things I'll chalk up as glad I did it and extremely glad I don't have to do it again. I had fun, don't get me wrong, but like, Jesus Christ, did I discover what the word tired can mean? There was a bit, it was just after the halfway point we were in. We did the fucking Dakotas, man. Like, we had great shows in Fargo and Sioux Falls, but like the left-hand side of those states, you could just snip them out and no one would care. I don't mean to be rude to people in the Dakotas, but like, fuck me. I remember getting back to like the Minneapolis show and just being like, I think I've already died. Like, you know, like this is so fucked. That we did it. We made a documentary about it, which is out now on Veeps. If people want to get the inside scoop on me being extremely tired for 50 days in a row. So check it out.
What was the worst travel you had to do? I'm assuming it was probably related to Alaska or Hawaii.
Yeah, the worst travel was probably Alaska. And what was annoying about it was initially not that bad. Basically, we played a show in Seattle, and then the next day we flew to Alaska, and then we had the show, and then the following day we were going to fly back to Portland and do the Portland show. And then about a week before, they canceled the daytime flight, no reason given. So we were like, what the fuck? And then it turned out there was still a flight, but it was after the show. So we played Seattle. The following morning, we flew to Alaska, played Alaska, and then went straight back to the airport and got on a plane at 1 a.m. We flew overnight back to Portland and then got off the plane and went to a venue and sound checked. And that fucking, and this was like three quarters of the way through the run as well. And it was like, I don't fucking need this right now. You know what I mean? Like, like I did not require this sort of bullshit at this point in this journey, but you know, we made it.
My least favorite state from touring is Wyoming. How was Wyoming for you?
Wyoming was great. It was my first ever show in Wyoming. So before the tour, I had 47 states. And about halfway through, I was like, man, we could have just done three shows. You know what I mean? We could have just done Wyoming, South Dakota, and Hawaii and called it a fucking day. But the Wyoming show was great. We played in Casper. We had a really good show. It was really fun. I hesitate to say this out loud because I don't want to disrespect anybody who did come to the show, but the ditch of the 50 states was Arkansas.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that just, it wasn't the best show. It wasn't the best attended show. It wasn't the best show. And it was just like, somewhere had to come last. You know what I mean?
Sure. Somebody's always got to come in last.
Yeah. And like I said, the people who did come were great and fantastic and good for them. But like, yeah, that one was a bit like, and it was like, you know what it gets like in the South? It was like soupy hot and just like, oh, what the fuck are we doing?
At least, was the audience at least receptive? They weren't antagonistic or anything?
They were. The audience were receptive and it was cool.
How was this experience? How did you compare it to the 15 shows in 24-hour period run you did in London?
I mean, the 15 shows thing was harder in the time that it lasted, but it didn't last for nearly as long. You know, it was one and done. The 15 shows thing, that got pretty fucking grim at about 6 a.m. We did midday to midday, and up to from midday through till like 4 a.m., everyone was just like out for a party, having a good time. And then we got to 6 a.m. and everyone at the show had just got out of bed, and like the energy level just went off a cliff. And it was exactly the moment when I really needed like a push from the crowd. You know what I mean? And it was like, I wasn't getting one.
How close did you keep the venues? Were they close?
Oh, they had to be at least 20 miles apart for the rules. So it was, we covered most of England.
Wow. Okay. And then, so another thing you did, I think this was this year, you on Record Store Day, you just worked a shift at Electric Fetus in Minneapolis.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Well, so basically I was on a US promo run, and you know, most of the time you do promo stuff during the week, and Record Store Day is a Saturday, and I had a Saturday free, and it was like I had to get from the East Coast to the West Coast, and it was like, fuck it, stop in Minneapolis. And I know the Electric Fetus crew, Dawn and Jim, they're great people. And so the idea was I would do like an in-store show, and they kind of jokingly said, well, you got to work a shift. And I was like, all right, motherfuckers, I'll work a shift. And then I got there and they were like, yeah, we were just kidding about that. And I was like, no, you said work a shift. I'm going to work a goddamn shift. Give me a staff shirt and show me what to do. So I did. I packed boxes all morning. It was fun. It was the most honest work I've done in a long time.
Did you get a paycheck?
I didn't. No.
What?
Wow.
Sue them.
I did get to keep the staff t-shirt though.
Oh, wow. They took that. They took your wages out of that, I guess.
They told me that the only other person who doesn't work there that they gave a staff t-shirt to was Sting.
Oh, wow.
So you got you and Sting, and then you got you and Rancid.
Right. And then if we're doing the 50 Safe thing, we've got me, George Thorogood, and the Melvins. And somewhere in this, we've got one hell of a dinner party.
Yeah.
All right. So next year, next February, you're playing your 3,000th show.
Yeah.
It's at the Alexandra Palace.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so the stuff we just talked about, the 50 states, the 24, this is all stuff that generated press for you.
Yeah, of course.
Here's my pitch. Record a ska album, release it on February 21st, all ska set. You'll get so much press.
I mean,
sell out.
I get a little press from you. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to write and record a ska album between now and then. I'm pretty busy in the meantime, making furious excuses as you went along. That's going to be a fun show, I think. It sold out in 24 hours, which is genuinely really not what I was expecting to happen. It's 10,000 people. And my team and I, we were like, hopefully, you know, maybe it'll sell out by the day of the show. That would be cool. That would be a nice statement. And the whole fucking thing went in 24 hours, which is actually kind of a problem. I mean, it's a good problem. Don't get me wrong. But we were like, fuck, what do we do now? You know, and we can't add any more shows before it because it's got to be the right number of shows. You know what I mean? So there's what it is.
Wow. So I want to ask you also, Nathan Gray, you and Nathan Gray are friends, and I think you're fans of them, or you know, you grew up fans of them as well, right?
The first proper show that I ever played was opening for Boyz II Men.
Wow. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nathan was on the show. Are you a fan of Iron Roses?
Yeah, definitely. We've toured together. We toured together in 2021.
That's right. Yeah. So Nathan was talking about you and talking about touring with you in Iron Roses. So I was just curious what you recalled about that and kind of Nathan's shift away from Boyz Sets Fire to Iron Roses.
Yeah. I mean, there is a shift there, but I mean, and I don't want to make this too self-involved, but like, so when I started doing acoustic stuff, folk, whatever you want to call it, as opposed to the bands I'd been in before, Million Dead and stuff like that, my feeling, my assumption about it was that it was completely radically different and there was no through line between the two at all, because that's how it was in my mind. But at the time, a few people sort of said to me, well, I mean, it's still you. So it still sounds like you, you know, and I guess as a writer, as a singer, as an artist, you have a certain imprimatur or whatever. And I kind of feel the same way about Nathan and Boyz II Men and Iron Roses. Of course, it's very different in many ways, but it's still Nathan. From the depths to the mountains, we struggle for our lives. The pushback is controlled by the same routine that keeps us scattered inside. Oh,
Yeah, I think there's really subtle things as songwriters that you do, like not you personally, just like a songwriter.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. And we all have our tics and habits and all the rest of it, and which we're probably not all that aware of.
A lot of times I think it boils down to like you're attracted to very specific chords, you're attracted to very specific like little melody things that you do.
Yeah, intervals and all the, yeah, completely. And so that's kind of what I mean about I Am Roses as well, yeah.
So you can play different styles, but then it still sounds like you. You know, what you can't help it.
You can't get your songwriter DNA out of the equation.
No.
So that's why we need that Frank Turner ska album.
You know what? Right, okay, I will say this to you, right? If I was going to make a ska record, if I was going to make a ska record, I would talk to the Bedouin Soundclash guys about making it. I would get them as my band. I think that I would want people who are like authentically steeped in that tradition. You know what I mean? Like the guys in my band are all incredible musicians and could do a possible ska sound, I'm sure. But I think that it would be better to work with people who are immersed in that world, you know?
Plus that sounds fun.
Yeah, I mean it would be fun. They're great people.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So, I mean, I've got to talk to Jay this week anyway, so maybe I'll float the idea with him.
Let's go.
I love that. Do it.
I just want to ask, we'll let you go in just a second. I was watching some stuff online. So are you friends with Converge?
Yeah.
And, okay. Did you, I think I saw some video where you were like on stage with them and crowd surfing.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a funny day. So Converge are like one of my all time favorite bands. I've got a big Converge tattoo up here. Like, and like, you know, I saw them in 98. Do you know what I mean? Like I've been a fan for a long time and, yeah. We've recorded at God City with Kurt and, we've hung out a bunch over the years. I mean, you know, obviously what we do is pretty different from each other and all the rest, but like they're good people. And I think they're one of the most reliably brilliant, startling, original heavy bands that's ever existed. And so, I mean, this was like 2014 or something, but they were playing in London. Yeah, I went down to hang out and to see the show. And, you know, Kurt saw the new guest list and I said, hi. And before the show, Jake was like, do you want to sing a song? And I was like, no, because I don't want to be that fucking guy who always has to get on stage, you know, whenever he goes to a show. So I said no, but then I was in the pit because I fucking love that band. And it was the last song of the show and they were playing Last Light. And Jake basically just grabbed me out of the crowd and just yanked me onto the stage and just fucking threw the mic at me for the best bit of the song. This is for the heart. And it was just like, well, it's happening now. It was a huge honor and it was super cool. And I fucking love that band. It was also hilarious because to the extent that, I have haters, which I do because I've achieved something with my life. If you were to draw up a kind of demographic profile of the people who hate my fucking guts, it would be English Converge fans, generally speaking. Despite the fact that I've been into that band longer than any of those pricks have. But the thing is, it's like it's also 2014. It was like I was writing high off like Where I Tend to Be, which is a pop song, and all the rest of it. And I think a lot of those kids had no idea that I had any kind of hinterland in that scene. So they're like, "What the fuck?" And like there was this huge kind of outpouring of hatred directed at me after I'd been on stage with Converge. It's just like, "Fuck all of you! I saw him in '98. Eat my fucking balls." I should say, by the way, that I'm more zen about this stuff than I was at the time.
This is the more zen version.
Yeah. I mean, who fucking cares at the end of the day? But indeed, it should be noted, as I say, I was attempting not to be the guy who had to get up and do a song, but I was forced into it, damn it. But it's just kind of funny, like, you know, I'll go and see bands like The Armed or Swans or all that kind of shit. And I've got a huge corner of my music taste for that kind of extremism, if you know what I mean. And like, there's always a couple of people who are like, what the fuck is that guy doing here? And it's just like, fuck all of you. I've been, you know, this is my hinterland.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online.
Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Frank Turner. Listening to you, Frank Turner. He knows exactly what to do. Hey, if you want to hear more Frank Turner, too bad. We only talked to him for 45 minutes.
We do have a different guest, though, waiting for us behind that curtain.
Oh, yeah. But yeah. You won't know who it is unless you sign up for our Patreon.
Yes. You never know. So you never know who's going to be waiting behind that curtain with us.
Usually it's the same guest, but sometimes these guys are real popular, like Frank Turner, and they got to keep moving. They got to go on to the next interview.
They got to go do the ska podcast, then the metal podcast.
Then the hardcore podcast, yeah, then the hip hop podcast, exactly. Then the What Food Is This podcast.
What food is this? The What Makes You Hungry podcast.
Join us over behind the curtain on our Patreon. And let's see what we got in store for you.